Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up a source file that is, well, it's one of those cases that really sits at the very edge of what we think we know.
It really does. It pushes right up against contemporary science.
We're going to be doing a deep dive into material on a case of potential reincarnation that is just so detailed, so consistent, that even the most, you know, hardened skeptics have had a really tough time explaining it away.
And that's the key phrase, isn't it? Explaining it away. Because for decades, they've tried. We're not talking about some fuzzy old folktale here. The file we've put together covers a series of events in 1950s England that, when you look at them all together, they form this this really powerful challenge to our whole understanding of memory, of consciousness itself.
And this case has a name. It's often called the Redwood Hollow Enigma.
For many researchers in this field, this is it. This is the gold standard.
So let's set the stage. The story begins with just an awful, awful tragedy. We're in a small town in England called Redwood Hollow. The year is 1956.
And it was the kind of tragedy that just rips the heart out of a small community. Two little sisters, Emily and Grace, they were only 6 and 4 years old, were killed in a car accident.
Just sudden. Violent.
Completely. And you have to imagine the devastation for the parents. The sources really stress this point. It was the completeness of the loss. Their entire future just gone in an instant.
We really have to start there with that emotion, because the depth of their grief and, more importantly, how they dealt with it becomes a really critical piece of the puzzle later on.
A crucial scientific parameter, actually.
Right. So tragedies like this, as horrible as they are, they do happen.
Mm-hmm.
What makes this one file so significant? Why is this the one that's so hard to dismiss?
Well, the researchers we've looked at often refer to this as the only reincarnation case scientists still refuse to explain.
That's a huge claim.
It's a massive claim. And it's not about the sheer amount of evidence. It's about the quality, the variety.
What you mean by variety?
I mean, the evidence isn't just one thing. It's not just, oh, a child said something weird. It covers physical marks like birthmarks. It covers deep psychological trauma. It covers specific memories of their lives. And this is the kicker. Knowledge of tiny, fleeting details that were verifiable.
So it's like the case is built on multiple pillars.
Exactly. Four separate pillars. And to dismiss the case, you don't just have to knock one down. You have to explain away all four of them at the same time. And that, it turns out, is almost impossible to do.
So we're going to unpack the structure of that evidence, piece by chilling piece, to really understand why it's earned that reputation. Okay, let's unpack this.
So let's start right after the tragedy in 1956. The sources, they really paint this picture of just a heavy, oppressive silence.
The parents are just trying to survive.
Just trying to get through the day. They're deep in mourning. A year goes by. The whole atmosphere in their home is one of suppressed grief, the accident, the girls' names, anything about their old lives. It was all completely off limits, locked away.
And that's so important. That suppression is vital for this case, isn't it? Because it helps rule out the most obvious explanation for what happens next.
Absolutely. It rules out the idea that the new children just, you know, overheard the story.
Right.
The scientific credibility of this whole file really hangs on the parents' testimony that they were incredibly strict about this. No talking about the accident, no mentioning Emily and Grace. They wanted a completely fresh start.
And then 2 years pass. It's 1958. And that silence is broken. The mother gives birth again.
But not to one child, to twin girls.
Wow. I mean, that in itself must have been just an emotional whirlwind, a new beginning, but also this echo of the two daughters they lost.
A profound echo. And this is really where the mystery starts to take shape. For a little while, everything was normal. They just had two healthy, happy babies.
But the sources are very clear about when things changed.
Very explicit. The quote is, "From the moment the twins could speak, things weren't normal." It is. They went from that sort of charming toddler babble to saying things, making statements that suggested this horrifying direct link to the tragedy from 2 years before.
So let's talk about the timing. The sources say the really strange behavior started when the twins were around 3 years old. Why is that specific age so important for researchers?
Oh, it's hugely significant. When we look at how memory develops in children, there's this thing called infantile amnesia.
Right, where you can't remember anything from when you were, say, one or two.
Exactly. Most adults have no clear memories before maybe age 5 or 6. Any memories you think you have from age 3 are usually really fragmented. They're unstable. They tend to fade very, very quickly.
So if a 3-year-old is suddenly talking in detailed narratives about an event they never saw, that implies their memory is working in a way that it just shouldn't be. It's bypassing the normal rules of brain development.
Precisely. We're talking about highly specific, emotionally charged memories popping up at an age when the brain should be in the process of forgetting, not cementing, those kinds of details. It's completely backward.
So let's get into it. The evidence didn't start with just vague feelings. It started with something tangible, something on one of the twins' bodies.
Right. Act two. This is where the lingering trauma starts to manifest, both physically and verbally. It's as if the entire experience of the accident, not just memories about it, was somehow transferred.
Let's start with the birthmark. This is really the first major piece of physical evidence in the file.
Okay, so one of the twins, when she's about three, she starts drawing her parents' attention to her knee. She points right at this very distinct birthmark.
And lots of kids have birthmarks. That's not unusual.
Not at all. But it was what she said about it, the context. That's what terrified the parents. She looked right at this mark on her knee, and according to the source material, she said very clearly, "This is where the car hit me."
I mean,
yeah.
What do you even do with that as a parent?
It's a staggering statement. It's not just, "I have a mark." It's connecting a physical feature on her new body directly to the fatal point of impact on a sister who died 2 years before she was born.
And this isn't a one-off idea, is it? In this field of research, this concept of birthmarks matching fatal wounds comes up again and again.
It does. It's a controversial but established area of study. But what makes the Redwood Hollow case so powerful is the child's own unsolicited explanation for it. She provided the mechanism. She didn't just have a mark. She knew or claimed to know how it got there.
A skeptic would say, it's a coincidence. The birthmark is just a birthmark.
Of course. And that's the first place your mind goes. But the sources say the parents, desperate for answers, actually looked into it. They checked the old police reports, and when they compared the location of the birthmark to the records, it was in the exact area where one of the sisters had taken a major catastrophic injury in the crash.
So the implication is that the memory of the trauma wasn't just in the mind. It somehow left a physical, anatomical signature on the new body.
Which, if true, completely shatters our standard biological model. It suggests that consciousness or information can influence how an embryo develops. That's a world-changing idea.
And while one twin carried this physical marker of the trauma, the other was showing the psychological side.
Exactly. It's like they split the experience between them. The second twin's trauma came out as this intense, very specific fear. She was terrified of the dark.
Not just a normal childhood fear.
No, this was profound. She refused to sleep without the lights on. We're talking full-blown night terrors if the room was dark.
And her reason. Her explanation for the fear wasn't, there's a monster under the bed.
It was incredibly specific. When her parents would try to comfort her, she'd explain her fear by saying, "The man in the car comes back when it's dark."
The man in the car. That is so detailed.
It's a targeted, narrative-based fear. It's tied directly to the circumstances of the accident and, the person who was driving the other car.
Which brings us back to that crucial scientific control. The parent's silence. If they truly never spoke about the details, How did a three-year-old learn about the man in the car?
That's the million-dollar question. This is where you have to consider the rational explanations. Things like cryptomnesia, where a forgotten memory of something she overheard pops up and she thinks it's her own.
But the sources say the parents were horrified precisely because they were so sure they'd never said a word about it in front of the twins.
And look, if the details were vague, like she was just afraid of a big crash, maybe you could argue for cryptomnesia. But the man in the car implies she knew there was a specific other person involved. For a toddler to piece that together from whispered, overheard conversations, it seems incredibly unlikely.
So you have the specific physical mark on one twin and the specific psychological trauma in the other. It's the combination that makes it so hard to dismiss as just a series of coincidences.
It's the pairing that's so compelling. It suggests a complete retained memory of the entire experience, the physical impact, and the psychological terror.
What's also fascinating is how her fear mirrors what you see in actual trauma patients. The trigger, in this case the darkness, brings back a vivid memory of the agent of the trauma. It's a classic PTSD response. But for an event she never experienced.
It suggests a continuity of the trauma response mechanism itself right across the boundary of death.
Here's where it gets really interesting. So if that was the evidence for the trauma of the past lives being carried over, the next phase shows an escalation into something even more detailed.
Right. This is where we move from the memory of death to to the memory of life. We start seeing detailed, shared biographical memories, the everyday stuff that really makes up a personality.
The behavior changed. It wasn't just a reaction to a past trauma anymore. It was more like an expression of ingrained habits, preferences.
Yes, exactly. A retention of the prior identity's actual attachments. The sources say the twins' behavior got even stranger when they started asking for things. Very specific things.
And we're not talking about just asking for a new doll for Christmas.
No, no. They were requesting toys they had never, ever seen in this lifetime.
How is that possible?
They weren't making generic requests, like for a teddy bear. They were asking, by description, for specific dolls. Or a little toy tea set that had belonged to Emily and Grace.
Which raises a huge question. How could they possibly know about toys that were probably packed up in the attic, or maybe even thrown away, years before they were born?
It implies they had access to this detailed mental inventory of their dead sister's possessions. It suggests memory isn't just about the big, life-ending moments. It retains the small, mundane details of what we loved, what we owned.
Now, a skeptic might say the parents were leading them on. You know, maybe they showed them an old photo album or just wanted to believe so badly that they misinterpreted things.
It's a valid point, but the sources are clear that the twins would often ask for items the parents themselves had completely forgotten about. It would force them to go digging through old boxes in the attic just to confirm that, yes, that specific toy actually existed. The level of detail was beyond what they could have known.
And it wasn't just about objects. It was about places and habits, too. Things that are much harder to fake than just saying something.
Right. Motor memory. Unconscious preferences. It's one thing for a child to make up a story. It's another thing entirely to exhibit a deep, unconscious habit that aligns perfectly with someone who's deceased.
Let's talk about the schoolyard first.
Okay, so the twins started describing their old schoolyard, the layout of the playground, the specific swings they liked, where they used to hide.
A place they had never been to in their current lives.
Never. The family had moved. This place was geographically unknown to them. It's as if they retained a perfect mental map of their old life, a spatial familiarity that just couldn't have been learned.
But maybe the most powerful example of this habitual memory is the car ritual. And this is so poignant, because the car was the very thing that caused the trauma they were so clearly remembering.
It's deeply ironic. Every single time the family would get in the car to go somewhere, the twins did the exact same thing. Without a word, they would quietly go to the same two spots in the back seat.
And these weren't just random seats.
They were the exact seats that their sisters, Emily and Grace, had always insisted on sitting in years before the accident. It wasn't something they talked about. It was just this automatic, ingrained habit.
So this isn't them performing. This is unconscious.
That's what makes it so convincing. If they were trying to act out a memory to please their parents, they'd probably be more dramatic about it. But the sources describe this as a quiet, automatic preference. It's like their bodies just knew where they were supposed to go in that car. It suggests the old personality's spatial preference just overrode anything new.
This is where the debate has to move beyond just psychology, right? If memory is just, you know, connections in our physical brain, how on earth is an unconscious habit like knowing which car seat is yours get transferred between two different brains born 2 years apart?
It connects right back to their fear. On one hand, they're terrified of the car. But on the other, their deepest, most unconscious habits draw them right back to the exact physical spots associated with their last moments alive. The mix of that trauma and that habit it's just profoundly strange.
So with all of this evidence piling up, the birthmark, the fear, the toys, the car seats, the parents are just, they must have been at their wits' end.
Crushed. Can you imagine? It's like living with the constant, uncanny ghosts of your lost children. The sources say they felt they had no choice. They decided to take this one desperate final step to try and understand what was happening.
They decided to go back.
They decided to take the twins back to Redwood Hollow, back to the old village where Emily and Grace had lived and where they had died. It was the ultimate test.
The moment of truth. They're taking the twins out of the controlled environment of their new home and putting them right on the stage of their past life.
You can feel the tension in the source material describing that trip. The parents drove in silence, just waiting, watching for any reaction.
And did they get one?
Oh, yeah. Instantly. The moment they stepped out of the car in the old neighborhood, the response was immediate. They were just walking down a street the twins had never seen in this life, and suddenly, the girls just froze.
They recognized it.
They did more than recognize it. That recognition instantly flipped into this overwhelming, pure joy. They started laughing, and then they just took off, running ahead of their parents, shouting back, "Come on, we know the way home."
Oh my God.
It's extraordinary. They weren't asking where to go. They were the tour guides in a place they had never been.
And the sources say they ran straight for the old playground.
Straight there, the heart of their old childhood, a place their parents had absolutely never taken them. It was a perfect display of retained spatial memory. But the real climax, the moment that pushes this case from just being deeply weird into a true scientific enigma, happened at that playground.
The chalk drawing.
The chalk drawing. This is the single most important piece of evidence in the entire file because it deals with a memory that was tied to a specific moment in time.
Walk us through it. What happened?
So they get to the playground. The emotional energy is just peaking. And one of the twins walks over to this low brick wall, nothing special about it. And she points at the wall.
And what does she say?
She whispers. And the quote is just devastating in its specificity. She says, "Grace drew that right before we died."
The level of detail there. She names the artist her sister Grace. She names the action drawing, and she timestamps it right before we died.
And you have to understand the parents' reaction here, because their reaction is the external proof. The sources say the mother just collapsed on the spot sobbing. The father said he couldn't breathe.
And this wasn't just because it was emotional. It was because the drawing proves something to them.
It was the definitive, irrefutable proof, because there was no drawing on the wall.
You name.
It had been washed away by the rain years earlier. It was a temporary, fleeting piece of kids' chalk art. It didn't exist anymore in the physical world. It was a detail known only to the immediate family, a shared secret between the dead sisters and their parents.
So the memory was of a physical thing that no longer physically existed.
Yes.
And it was a memory that was time-stamped to the moments right before the trauma that ended that life.
It's like finding a deleted file from an old version of a hard drive. It absolutely destroys every normal explanation you could come up with. Fraud, parental suggestion, cryptomnesia.
Yeah.
There is no way for those children to have known about a temporary chalk drawing that was erased by the weather years before unless that memory was carried over intact inside their consciousness.
Let's just sit with that for a second. In this kind of research, verbal memories can be sketchy. But a memory of something physical that isn't there anymore, how do you even begin to explain that?
You can't. Not with our current models. The power of the chalk drawing is its temporal specificity and its transient nature. If they just described the old house, you could argue they saw a photo. But a piece of chalk art from minutes before your death, that's a self-destructing piece of evidence. The only way to verify it is through the raw emotional confirmation of the parents who were there. And that's why this single detail is the one that researchers who try to debunk these things, they just can't get past it.
So when you put it all together,
yeah.
The birthmark, the specific fears, the seating habits in the car, and then this impossible knowledge of a washed away drawing. It's just an avalanche of evidence.
It's the density and the variety of it. That's why it's the Redwood Hollow Enigma. The evidence implies a transfer of information, of consciousness, that is so complete, so detailed. It suggests consciousness can encode everything, maps, injury locations, fleeting images, and just transport it all across the gap of death into a new body.
And for those parents, in that moment at the playground, any skepticism they might have had was just gone.
Their tears were the final data point. They didn't need a scientist to tell them what was happening. They were looking at their lost daughters, who were laughing about a ghost of a chalk drawing.
So let's try to synthesize all of this. It's a lot to take in.
It is, but it's crucial to see how the pieces fit together to challenge our whole worldview.
We basically established four distinct categories of evidence, right? Each one of them, on its own, would be hard to explain.
Exactly. First, you have the physical pillar, that birthmark matching a fatal injury. That points to a physical memory of trauma. Second, the psychological pillar, the specific narrative-based fear that matches the details of the accident, which is so important because of the parents' silence.
Then third, the biographical pillar. This is all the stuff about their lives, asking for the specific toys, knowing the layout of the schoolyard, and an incredibly powerful car seat habit. That's evidence of a transferred personality.
And then the fourth, and maybe the strongest pillar, is the temporal evidence. The chalk drawing. The knowledge of something that was temporary that no longer existed and was verifiably created moments before death. That's the one that slams the door on almost every conventional explanation.
And this wasn't happening in a vacuum. This is a small English town. People knew the family. They knew the story of Emily and Grace. This became part of the town's own story.
It did, which leads us to the enduring cultural impact of it all in Redwood Hollow. The sources say the local consensus, what the community came to believe after hearing the parents' story, it provides the human answer to this scientific mystery.
And there's that quote that just sums it all up.
Yeah. In Redwood Hollow, they say, those weren't just twins, those were two sisters who came back.
That sentiment, it captures the reality that the community felt they were witnessing. The personalities, the trauma, the memories of Emily and Grace just seemed to reappear fully formed in these two new bodies.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, what does a case like this, which is still so hard to explain away decades later, really tell us about consciousness? I mean, if memory, including motor habits, spatial maps, and knowledge of fleeting events can transfer between bodies, then it suggests that memory and personality have to exist, at least in part, independently of the physical brain.
The standard scientific view is that when the brain dies, the self is gone, period. But this case, with a birthmark and especially that chalk drawing, it points to some kind of information transfer that's, well, it's not biological as we understand it.
It forces you to ask some really profound questions. If the physical mark of a trauma can be carried over, what else can be? Is there some kind of informational template of who we are, our loves, our fears, our talents? And what happens when two distinct personalities, Emily and Grace, seem to transfer into two new bodies at the same time? What does that even mean for the idea of an individual soul?
So what does this all mean for you listening to this? We've just gone through a case where physical marks and tiny, momentary details seem to span lifetimes. This deep dive really shows the incredible persistence of a personal story.
It kind of compels you to turn that same questioning inward. You have to ask about the origins of your own deep-seated feelings, your own innate skills or phobias, or those weird moments of déjà vu that don't have any logical source in this life.
Right. Think about those strange fears you might have, a fear of heights or water that isn't connected to any bad experience you've had, or a talent that you just seem to have that you never really had to work for. This case suggests those might not just be random quirks. They could be leftover data points.
What forgotten memory, linked to some moment of incredible passion or deep trauma from a life you can't remember, might you be carrying forward right now without even knowing it? The Redwood Hollow enigma kind of demands that we question the boundaries of who we think we are. Maybe the past isn't as far behind us as we think.
A truly challenging and deeply profound deep dive. Thank you for walking us through all that material.
It was a pleasure. It's a crucial story to explore.
We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.